tell by the strange Calliope music that it's Radio Mysterioso. Wait just a second. Kenny, you there?
Yeah, Kenny? I'm not hearing you very well, though.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Well, I'll hold the phone up closer when we do the show.
Okay.
Maybe I will play the intro music. Just a minute. Yeah, it's a Calliope CD I bought in New Orleans. There was another song I wanted to use for the opening, but maybe we'll just use the normal one this time. No, this one.
Interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend,
how do you reward the innocent?
Can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
I never really thought about it. How do you reward the innocent? I know how you punish the guilty. I guess you reward the innocent by leaving them alone. Who knows? Let's hook Ken into the system here. Hey, Ken, can you hear me? Oh, wait, there we go.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, that's perfect. Ken Thomas
hello.
Is... Hello. Ken Thomas is America's best loved conspiracy researcher, a term coined and trademarked by our friend Rob Sterling. And Ken said, "You want to? Can I be on the show tomorrow? Do you have somebody on?" I said, "No, you're on." So I just called, and Ken was very relaxed, and I said, "Are you stoned?" He said, "Why would you even ask that question?" I said, "Because you sound really relaxed." So he's just really relaxed. Anyway, hi, Ken. Welcome. Good to talk to you again. And how you doing?
Well, actually, tired is another way of describing my state of mind.
Okay.
More than relaxed. But I'm getting feedback now.
Oh, let me turn that down a little bit. Okay, how about that? Okay. Is that a little bit better? I don't know. I was trying to combine my voice, because I'm talking to you through the phone. So, go ahead.
Right, and I'm on a phone.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're lucky they can hear me at all.
Well, I can hear you great, because I just take the phone, the earphone, headphone output of the phone and plug it into the board here, and it seems to work fine. You remember the board at Kel Radio.
Oh, yeah, sure. Been there many times.
I was thinking maybe we should do the show closer to the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, but when people say, hey, can I be on the show, or do you want me on the show, there's nobody on. I usually just say yes without thinking.
Well, we're pretty close to the assassination. I mean, your next show will be after the assassination, right?
That's true. Okay, because it's 22nd, right?
This is why I called you up and said, let's do a show. It's our last chance to do one before
the
big anniversary day.
Yeah.
And it's also why I sound so tired, because you can imagine how busy I get typically this time of year and how much more busy I am on the 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, are you going down to Dallas?
It's still kind of iffy. Probably
at
not.
At this
you know,
point,
Oliver
still?
Oliver Stone's actually going to be here.
In St. Louis.
And he's showing his JFK movie at an international film festival that's run by a friend of mine. So I can stay here and hang out with Oliver Stone. Or I could go to Dallas. And, you know, Dallas, what's going on in Dallas is a little strange. They're cordoning off Dealey Plaza. And a lot of the conspiracy people have been in a battle with City Hall down there to get just to get the right to set up tables and sell their wares and pass out their literature. But in order to actually get into Dealey Plaza, you had to do a lottery. They had a lottery, and I had to give them my passport and DNA sample, promise them my firstborn, all this shit, and I've won the lottery, so I can get into Dealey Plaza if I go. It's going to be like, if you've got your lottery ticket, you can, at 6 a.m., you can begin to stand in line for entrance into Dealey Plaza. It's not going to be the most pleasant of experiences.
No, not at all. It's crazy. Of course they're going to do that this year, of all years. And there's no conspiracy, because apparently you're allowed to be in there if you can get there at 6 in the morning.
Right, exactly. And I have my little pass, So... I haven't bought a plane ticket yet, and this late in the game, the jet basically says it's probably not going to be there. But, I could do it tomorrow.
Yeah, you could.
I just got back. I just did a JFK lecture in San Jose last weekend.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Who was there?
This was a UFO con, so it was mostly UFO people. Sean Morton spoke, but also conversations.
Sean Morton is a dick. Okay, there. Go ahead.
Is that obligatory every time
yes.
his name comes up?
So only UFO person I dislike intensely. Everybody else is kind of like, yeah, well, whatever.
Well, the guy I had the most interesting conversation with was Stephen Bassett. He did a disclosure lecture, and what was interesting about that was very recently one of the theories that have been recirculating is the idea that the Secret Service agent accidentally shot Kennedy.
Have
you heard that theory?
Yeah. I mean, I heard it, 15, 20 years ago when Bill Cooper was sending around that tape about it?
Well, no, there's more to it than just Cooper. There was a writer named Bonar Miniger who wrote a book called Mortal Error, which made that case, and other people made the case. Well, the Secret Service agent, and again, this is a long story getting back to my discussion with Stephen Bassett and the disclosure movement.
Yeah.
Where was I?
Stephen Bassett.
This guy, the Secret Service agent, when those theories first came out, he hired a lawyer, and the lawyer won many cases and made a mint for the guy. But the reason that
William, whatever his name was, the guy's name was William something. I can't remember his last name.
The Secret Service agent's name.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It was William.
His lawyer's name.
Okay, go ahead.
But the idea is, though, this guy made a lot of money, shot a lot of people down. But the reason they can recirculate the theory now is that that guy, whatever his name was, is dead. And you don't have defamation rights after you die.
Right.
So they can trot it out again. So anyway, they had one guy like that on Geraldo. And so Geraldo went to his friend, the lawyer who actually defended our Secret Service agent guy, whatever his name is, and that guy's name is Mark Waid, W-A-I-D.
Yeah.
And I'm explaining all this to Stephen Bassett, right?
Yeah.
And he says, I know Mark Waid. And Mark Waid is among the people that, he deals with, because Bassett spends a lot of time in D.C. with the disclosure movement, right? He's trying to get some lawmaker attention to behind it. And he knows Mark Waid. So I went into this whole thing with him about how the JFK community and the UFO community, they've got lots of similar concerns. If you know Mark Waid, because Mark Waid knows John Judge, who's running the COPA conference in Dallas this weekend. So what you should do, Stephen, is give a talk to a COPA conference. Give a talk to a JFK conference because, disclosure, it doesn't matter what you're on to. They need to open up many more files on JFK. But there's lots of UFO files that need to be disclosed as well.
Yeah.
And there can be an alliance there, We should, instead of being this kind of fragmented community that we always have been in a world of parapolitical study, we should build these bridges. But he backed off of that intensely. He said, oh, no, that would never, you know, and I'm not quite sure why.
Because he doesn't want to be associated with JFK assassination theory nuts. That's why.
Actually, my thought was he probably thinks the JFK people don't want to be associated with the UFO business.
No, there's a lot of that on both sides.
Yeah. I think that's a shame. I think that's a bit pity. Because they're both small communities and, they need to form alliances and, and it's not just them. I mean the JFK assassination is really, should be a gateway drug into the whole world of conspiracies and parapolitics.
Yeah.
I kind of lose sight of the fact because all year long at Steam Shovel Press Facebook, all I've been doing is JFK stuff because of the 50th anniversary.
Right.
But, it's just one specialty within, the wider group of topics that I've always written about, all the conspiracies.
Yeah.
Are you still there? I'm getting dropouts.
Yeah, I'm still here. I was just reading it. Secret Service agent shot JFK, and it's got the accidental one where the guy in the car behind him supposedly shot him by accident when the car slowed down. No, we're right. Talking about the one right. Where the guy supposedly turns around and shoots him.
That's William Greer. I mean, that's the famous.
That's it. That's
Bill
it.
Cooper
Williams
scenario.
I mean, Greer. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
George.
Do you remember?
George Hickey is the other one.
That's it. George Hickey. Yeah. That was him. And he recently died, and therefore they could jot these things out. Do you remember a guy named Ruffin Prevost?
Yes, we spent some time with him over at his family compound there out in the Inland Empire in that nice clubhouse he had for the family business.
Right. Well, remember his, I think his uncle
yeah.
was William Greer's dentist. Right?
I didn't know that.
Right. And so William Greer, for those listening who do not know, is the guy who supposedly turned around and shot Kennedy from the driver's seat of the limo, according to Bill Cooper. Bill Cooper had this really nasty copy of Zapruder film and made it look like that happened. And it didn't really. It didn't. But the fact that it didn't actually doesn't totally cut Greer out of the loop of culpability. I mean, the Zapruder film and the other films of the day showed brake lights coming on as he drives into the sniper's pit there. So,
yeah,
that can only be Greer slowing the car down,
right?
For whatever reason, yeah.
Down to what is it, 22 miles an hour, or whatever? Now I can't remember the name of the guy. Now I can't remember his name. The was he a general or a colonel, or I can't remember who it was that said that that you can shoot somebody going like 22 miles an hour, but you can't shoot them going like 15 or 25. It's easiest to shoot them going at 22 or something like that.
Oh, really? I don't know who said that.
Who was Mr. X in?
Fletcher Prouty.
Yeah, Fletcher Prouty actually mentioned that.
Right. Well, I'm glad you brought him up because I've been chatting him up as much as possible with places I've been going to. You don't see him on
he's
CNN
still around?
Or MSNBC or any of those places.
Is he still around?
But, you know, there was. What's that?
Is he still around?
Fletcher Prouty, no, he died a number of years ago.
Yeah, I thought so.
But I did talk to guy named Mark, I don't know if I have his last name, but he's connected to Wendy, who does the Grenada for him.
Yeah.
He's really, really big on Fletcher Prouty, and he has Fletcher Prouty DVDs there.
Yeah, this is a group that meets out here in L.A., out in the San Fernando Valley, yeah.
Right, yeah. And Wendy was there. I hadn't seen her in many years, and she actually wants me to do a show with her on the night of the 22nd. I really don't know if I'm going to do that. But, talking about Fletcher Prouty. Well, one of the interesting things that has happened recently is on a History Channel, they've been running a Lone Nut special with a critic named Max Holland, who is trying to make the case that the Zapruder stopped filming somewhere way short of the Stemmons Freeway sign for just a brief second, just at the exact moment that Oswald made the first shot. And this is another rationale for the magic bullet theory, because if you can say that, you can expand the 5.6 seconds by which all three shots were made by something like, you know, 4 seconds. So it's, you know, it's a ridiculous and convoluted theory, but it helps to, you know, support this ridiculous and convoluted idea that one bullet did all that damage in that amount of time.
Which, yeah, I still find it hard to believe. Have you seen that somebody, I think from New Zealand, did a interpolation of the frames, so it's 30 frames a second? It's kind of surreal looking to see it at a normal video rate.
Yeah, and it's all stabilized too, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's
not jumping in it, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's amazing. And, I mean, we have a very clear view of the Zapruder film now. And you know, 50 years of all this different kinds of theorizing has done nothing to erode what you can clearly see in the film. You know, it's an event that was filmed and taped. And in particular, they sync up the tape, the sound, to the film.
Yeah,
you can see what's happening there. You know, and
really, how I've never heard this a sound recording synced up to it. I just haven't paid enough attention. What happens? See, because I don't disagree with you about it, but the way I do with you about the Reich and Roswell thing.
you know that whole exchange verse is in my new book, right?
No, I didn't know that. That's great.
It's a whole chapter, actually. You know, I call it chapter steam shovel number 24. Actually, we should go into this a little more because I can tell your listeners how they can get a free copy of the book.
Okay. Well, maybe we can finish the sound synced up with Zapruder film comment.
Well, you see, the sound synced up to the Zapruder film, Greg, is the evidence that convinced the House committee in the late 70s to conclude conspiracy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's very, you know, very important. You know, people don't exist. I mean, there are people out there who say at that exact very moment, actually, no, one of the police motorcycles backed up, and that's the sound you hear. But nobody believes that. And the sound syncs up perfectly with the Zapruder film and demonstrates 4 shots. You know, I mean, there could have been a 5th shot that wasn't recorded, but
yeah,
it's all very clear. And, you know, clear enough to make that the official view. You know, which I'm always dumbfounded about these specials. I keep going back to thinking that, you know, the two views on this are the people who believe the Warren Commission and those crazy conspiracy nuts. Well, those crazy conspiracy nuts are your government, because that's exactly what the government concluded.
It's true, yes. And it's funny, at the Assassination Museum, they actually cover that. The Sixth Floor Museum actually covers the some of the conspiracy stuff and says, yes, well, the government did conclude in a special committee in 1977 that it was most likely the result of a conspiracy, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if he still runs it, but a guy named Gary Mack used to run the Sixth Floor Museum. And he comes out of the conspiracy research community.
Huh.
Which is, I'm amazed. You know, I'm sure he soft pedals it mostly.
Yeah.
But in order to keep his job. But yeah, you know, so it's what everybody believes, what you see in the film. It's just a matter of common sense. So when you see, like, two of the things I was watching the other day, one of them was that new Parkland movie, and we talk about that later. But the other was the Nova special that they just did, once again demonstrating how the magic bullet theory can work using science.
I'd like to see it and be convinced.
And you not only come away with, you know, no confidence at all that these people in this special did anything to prove anything, but you got to wonder about the science in every other Nova special you ever watched. I mean, I came away doubting the Big Bang Theory after watching their
We both know that ultimately, in a lot of cases, unless you're real careful, science is just like the assassination thing, for and against, UFO stuff, all that, is what the thinker thinks, the prover proves, like our friend Bob Wilson used to say. So you have to be real careful about what people are saying and real careful about what you believe or how much you hold on to your belief. I'm always wanting to be convinced.
Of the Warren Commission in the first place. They say it in the memos. They're not out to solve the case. They're out to
calm everyone down.
Calm the people down, to reassure the people, you know. So if that's what they want to do, then that's what they did. But, you know, in this case, it's not really just a matter of what the thinker thinks. It's what anybody can see on the movie, on the film. And, you know, and there's a lot of, like, what I like to do is listen to people's story of the assassination and see if the details kind of fit in with the puzzle. The best example of this recently has been Robert McNeil. To me, it's kind of recent. Did you know, remember the old McNeil Lehrer report?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was he the one that never blinked, or was that Lehrer? That was Jim Lehrer. He never blinks. It's kind of scary.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, McNeil has a book out now, a fictionalized account of the assassination. So it's fictionalized. There's no big controversy there. But the fact that it was out got me to remembering what McNeil always said about the assassination. He was there when it happened. He ran up the grassy knoll, just like all the other witnesses ran up the grassy knoll to the picket fence. And then he decided he had to file the story, so he went over, walked over toward the school book depository, desperate to find a phone, asked the guy standing there, hey, where's the phone? And the guy says, oh, there's one right over there. That guy, Neil says, was Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah.
And, you know, Oswald's story, the story that Oswald tells, he's on a second floor sipping a Coke, heard the commotion and kind of walked out to see what was going on. If he had just shot the president on the sixth floor, you know, and was trying to escape, ran down four flights, and was ready to bolt, did he really have time to leisurely tell this guy who was asking where the phone was? You know, would he have the time or the inclination to do that?
No.
So McNeil's
unless he's
story
wrong.
Fits Oswald's story. It fits into the puzzle.
Yeah. McNeil says?
I don't know. Huh. I have not seen him say anything more than the story.
Huh.
I don't know. He doesn't fit it in. I've never seen him fit it in, you know, what Oswald said about his own story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why I think this right now, but, and it's a really stupid question. But if somebody's listening to this, and this is the first time they've actually encountered somebody thinking carefully about what happened during the JFK assassination, what? See, I could ask you, you know, what is the best evidence, to coin a phrase? I know this sounds elementary between you and I, Ken, and I haven't thought about it in years, but, I mean, just as a, I don't know, a jumping off point for somebody that would care to look into it. Because it would probably depend on their personality, what they're going to look at. But what would be the best case? Short version. I'm not going to answer the phone because we're still doing our talk here.
What? Okay, so somebody totally unfamiliar with anything having to do with the assassination, what should
somebody
what
that
should
doesn't
they look at
doesn't
that
care, but
convince them.
Yes, doesn't care, but suddenly cares to find out. Oh, good, they stopped calling. Somebody doesn't care up to now, but just says, hey, what the hell? I'd like to look into it. You know, what's the easiest, best way for somebody without reading all of Garrison or without watching the JFK movie, which would probably be pretty easy, you know, a site, a book?
Yeah. Well, just watch the Zapruder film. Just watch the Zapruder film, and what do you think happens there? And
yes.
You can see quite clearly that he gets shot in the head.
Back into the left.
Backward.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you know, I could go on and on. I could tell you who hit me really kind of thinks are the shooters other than Oswald.
Yeah.
You know, he was shot from the Dow Tech building by a guy named Jim Radin, otherwise known as Edgar Eugene Bradley. And the reason Garrison was never able to prosecute him was because Ronald Reagan, your wonderful governor of your beautiful state, would not extradite him. The shooter from the grassy knoll, the case I've been trying to make, and the case that Garrison was making, is Fred Crisman, who's the guy that's connected up to the Maury Island case.
Is that really what Garrison said? He thought it was Crisman?
Absolutely, yes. That's absolutely who he thought the grassy knoll shooter was, Fred Crisman. And the fact that that's even a question in your mind is something that I'm only really beginning to discover, that nobody knows Crisman's name. And nobody knows that's who Garrison said was the shooter. And, I mean, there's lots of reasons for that. When Johnny Carson went on The Tonight Show, he brought a picture of the tramps, and he held it up, and he was about to say, this guy, this is Fred Crisman. But Johnny Carson shut him down before he could even get the name out.
How do you know he was going to say Fred Grisman?
Because that's his case. He believes that Grisman was in the employ of Boeing. Hello?
Yeah.
Greg? Oh, okay. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I keep feeling
you're still there.
Okay. Get this feeling in the car.
But just have faith. You're still on.
Okay. So anyway, that's axiomatic. That's as a matter of fact, that scene, that whole scene with Johnny Carson, is in the home versions of Oliver Stone's movie. It was never in the theatrical release again. And Stone doesn't mention Crisman either. And it's very odd. There are a lot of things that Crisman did that he didn't get to take to court. Edgar Eugene Bradley is a perfect example. He couldn't get him extradited. Reagan refused.
Yeah.
So what you have in Oliver Stone's movie is the whole case against Clay Shaw, which obviously failed. But that wasn't his whole case. That was what Garrison had enough of to be able to take to court in the time frame.
So Garrison, in his documentation and somehow in his documentation that's not as public as his other stuff, fingered Crisman. I mean, you told me this before, but I can't remember how you told me how you came to that conclusion.
Well, you can read about it on the Trail of the Assassins.
Oh, okay.
Book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he does mention Crisman in it. All right. Yeah. And fingers him, I guess.
Yeah. Now, on the sixth floor, they actually recovered a fingerprint of Mac Wallace, who was a trigger man that Johnson had used to take care of some of his political enemies in Texas. So it's Max Wallace, Edgar Eugene Bradley, Fred Crisman, and his team, which seems likely to be E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis. Now, if that seems unlikely to you, one of the things you have to remember, and I realize we've lost the general audience here, so we'll try to get back to
we don't have a general audience, Ken. This show is not a general audience, so don't worry about
it. All right, so those specialists who've been following this discussion or who maybe have read my book or Garrison's book or whatever, the connection between the idea that Fred Crisman is connected to Hunt and Sturgis, who were Watergate burglars, is made stronger by recent documentation that surfaced that indicated that Crisman got his job at the Hanford nuclear power plant in the Pacific Northwest, that the guy who approved his application was Mark Felt, who is
Deep Throat
in Watergate. So there's more than just Hunt and Sturgis that connect us up to Watergate. And, in fact, the point that I made before, too, is that Felt was a consultant to Quinn Martin Productions, which produced The Invaders, which was a TV show that Fred Crisman said was about his life.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you did. You have mentioned that. Yeah, I think you mentioned that on my show, actually.
Yeah, probably so. Probably so, yeah.
Oh, good. You can hear me now. Carlos... I think Carlos is in Austin. He is in Texas. He said the Nova special even contradicted itself about the ammunition test.
I think I noticed that too. Yeah. The Nova special is just a joke. In fact, I made the point at Steam Shovel Facebook that this is the one last service that JFK continues to provide Americans is the exposure that it does of people like that do the Nova special, who are basically what I would call scientific bureaucrats, you know, who know that they've got a narrative that they have to prove, and they twist the science to do it. And like I said, I came away from the special not only realizing that, you know, here's another ridiculous attempt to support the single bullet theory, but just wondering, you know, if they're bad on this, and I just happen to know something about this topic, what's the science like on all those other topics that Nova covers that I don't know anything at all about.
Yeah, well, that's what I mentioned. Go ahead.
Yeah. So that's, it gives you a healthy skepticism.
Yeah, well,
Thank you, JFK.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think it probably is a case-by-case basis. If there's not a bunch of people who are invested in some – well, there always are. But – you know, something not political, like the Big Bang Theory, there's probably a bunch of people that are completely against it and have other ideas about the origins of the universe. But that, you know, that's probably the reigning, you know, it's the reigning paradigm. It's not, it's starting to crumble, but it's the reigning paradigm right now. So that's the one they present. Because it's hard to present alternative views. Well, because then people have to think and consider, you know, which is hard.
Well, people have to fill in the blanks themselves. I mean, like this other special that I just said with Max Holland, who's been a lone nutter student of JFK for all these years. You know, when you figure that, you know, why is he presenting? I mean, they're always saying that these conspiracy theories are also convoluted. Why does he have just this convoluted idea that Zapruder shut down his movie and just at that moment Oswald fired his first shot, you know, something unbelievable like that. And you can see that's because there's an agenda there. They want to expand the amount of time it took to make those shots, to make the Civil Bullet theory more credible. So there's an agenda, you know, if you can figure that much out. But, you know, we don't know what kind of agendas are being played out on any particular Nova special at any given time.
Yeah, you never know. Hey, Ken, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, but the thing is, there is a consistent history. One of the points I try to make to people is, what I've been doing in my lectures lately is I present like three of the guys from prison who have confessed to the JFK assassination. And I make the point that anybody can confess to anything, anybody can believe anything. But when you consider that the government's view is that it was a conspiracy, that Garrison had a pretty good case. In fact, when they polled the jurors, they all believed that Clay Shaw was guilty. They just didn't think that technically the evidence was there to bring in a guilty verdict. And these are, you know, and Garrison brought a team of investigators, enormous resources, and much closer to the event than now. All of that has more weight than just anybody's confession or anybody's opinion. You know, there are things you can understand, and if you can get the scenario straight when you hear something new, you know it either fits the scenario or it doesn't. You know, and you know you can get you don't walk away in a fog. I noticed tonight on CNN playing some special on the assassination, and it's a lot of jump cutting.
There, one siren.
And, you know, Garrison's in there, and Lane is in there. You know, it's not that they're not showing the critics, but it's all jump cutting. So, right, so it gives you the smorgasbord, and, oh, see how confusing it is. This guy says this guy says that. You know, oh, my head hurts too much. I can't think about this. But, you know, I can assure people that you can't understand this event.
Hey, Ken, you said after the 50th anniversary you were going to stop and become a landed gentry and do your garden or whatever. Is that still what you're going to do?
Yes, absolutely. After November 22nd, steam shovel Facebook goes blank. Goes dead, and I'm done. Really.
Just tired of it?
Well, I mean, it's a good time to get off the carousel. I'm not going to turn down any work. You know, if somebody wants me to lecture, let me know. You know, if you're gonna, I can do the lecture, but I'm just not gonna beat the bushes anymore. The community is weak right now. It's kind of sad. I probably shouldn't abandon it at its hour of need. In fact, remember when I first started Steam Shovel, it was because we're in a position similar to where we're at now. I mean, Mae Brussels had died, and critique had stopped happening, and the whole conspiracy, the whole idea that people could even think about critically about conspiracy, let alone, you know, be active about it, publish a magazine or put together conferences and all that other stuff, that really seemed to be disappearing. And that's why I started Steam Shovel Press. That's why I turned Steam Shovel Press from what it was into a conspiracy magazine, just to hold that together and to try to make the community stronger, because it's, you know, I got off on that. And the stuff I read, you know, was, and if I was going to continue to read it, I obviously was going to have to write it and publish it, too. Well, we're back at that, you know. The opportunities for speaking have dwindled to next to nothing. And a lot of that is to the social media, you know. Let's just do it on Skype now. And people have died, you know. Mosley's gone, right? It's an aging fleet. Tim Beckley's really quite ill now. And it's just, you know, it's just gotten to be a smaller thing. And harder and harder to find people to convince that they need to have me at their conference, because there are fewer and fewer people. This conference that I just went to in San Jose, that was, you know, it's an offshoot of Conspiracy Con.
Yeah.
Because the promoter of Conspiracy Con got into some legal trouble. This woman who did this got into some legal trouble, but she continued to do it. She charged like $80 a pop, and it was like at a senior center. And really, up until the last minute, she was wanting me to Skype it and phone it in. So it was, you know, even that event was just barely there. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I'm old. I'm old. I don't have the energy I did when I first started Steam Shovel Press, nor the time.
Well, then what keeps you going? I guess reading Pynchon's new novel.
Oh yeah, Bleeding Edge. Fascinating, yeah. Excellent stuff. It takes place right at 9/11.
What does
right
he say about 9/11
happens?
Really, what does he say about it?
I'm not that far into it. It's mostly about the state of the internet was at that time, right before 9/11. And is this woman is a fraud investigator, and she has a couple of small kids. And I think I'm only kind of like halfway through it. I think what's actually happening is the effect that everything has on the children. And it's probably going to end on something like, you know, post 9/11. This new, the new generation that happened after that, you know, I think he's going to try to frame what he's saying is what might be their outlook. I don't know. I mean, he's pinching. I can't, nowhere near as elegant as he is with words. So.
Yeah. Well, I tried to read Mason and Dixon, and I got about to the pot scene, and I kind of petered out after that.
You petered out after pot.
Yes, no, the one where they're talking about growing hemp on their Washington,
well, you know,
talking about growing hemp.
Well, Pynchon writes a couple of different kinds of novels. He writes the Mason and Dixons and the Gravity's Rainbow.
Yeah,
and there was another, but then he writes detective novels. This is one of his detective novels.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's like Vineland. You know, they're small, much more accessible. The ideas are still there, but they're not as intensely packed as they are on those yak chokers that he produced. Yeah. So, So anyway, I haven't published. My new book is out.
Oh yeah. Which one?
And that's a collection of kind of my last essays. And that's a good way to cap things. You know, I think I'm not sure how many books I have out there, probably close to 15. I could go, but, you know, you make a good point. I'm older now. I mean, you've backed off the scene a lot yourself, haven't you?
I was about to mention that as we got in a lull here. I was thinking of all the things we've talked about and all the stuff that we've been exposed to and all the people we've talked to and all the opinions we've, you know, aired, disagreed with, agreed with, and all that. I find that there's not much difference. And I think, well, and then I get to that point where that Jacques Vallée said, where he wasn't learning anything anymore. I don't learn anything new every time I go back to these subjects, because I immerse myself so heavily in them for so long that when somebody says, well, look at this cool thing, it's like, I had that in my magazine 20 years ago. I don't care to even look at it anymore. And until I hear something new, I just kind of, I'm not interested. Is that how you feel?
I do feel that way in many ways. In the past, when I felt that way, I've actually felt that way for a long time, I kick into another gear, though. I feel as if what I need to do then at that point is just popularize what I already know and try to present it to more people, to teach them what I know. But kind of like you, I had that idea that I don't just want to review what everybody knows. I want to advance the understanding of that.
Yeah.
You know? Move the story along. And I don't see, you know, I think these stories have been moved as far along as I can push them.
Yeah, me too. I'm waiting for somebody else to do it. You know, there's a few people, but only a little. I'm waiting for other people to do it, and you're still doing, you know, on my show like this, and you still do some lectures. But the thing is, the only thing left I'm doing to keep my interest in this is this show. And once in a while, there's something new that comes up, and I go, hey, that's interesting, and I may look into it. You know, I got a few things from Nick Redfern the other day. I talked to him for about an hour, not on the show, and he just kind of rekindled my interest in a few little mysteries that aren't that real important, but they're interesting to me. So.
Right. Well, I think we're kind of on the same page there. But it would be nice if there were new people coming along all the time. But Mac Tonys was like the last guy to ever really do anything new. And the other thing is that.
Well, there's a couple right now.
What's that?
There's a few people right now. There's a guy, Bruce Duen Sinning or something like that. He does very good UFO and paranormal essays and theorizing. And Micah Hanks does the same thing. And he's a good promoter, too, so that helps. So those two, there's a few that are, you know, and I'm sorry if I'm forgetting others in the UFO field, but to me, those people are sort of trying to push it forward a little bit. But until this phenomenon changes, it does something different. Not abduction, something else. I don't know what that next thing's going to be.
But, well, you know, and you're talking the specialized subcult of just UFOs, you know.
Yeah, well, conspiracy stuff is a specialized subcult too.
Right. Nothing's happening on any of those fronts. I mean, where is the new Jim Keith? Which brings to mind another thing is that it's nice to get out of it and have some kind of retirement from it. And some time in your life where you can look back on it. Jim Keith didn't get that. A lot of guys, Danny Castellaro didn't get that. You know, a lot of people in this world are taken away suddenly. And, you know, I don't want to be one of those. I want to be able to look at the books on my shelf, think of the old days and raise a glass to parted friends kind of a thing and not always be on all the time.
Yeah, well, I am going to come visit you in 2017 when the total eclipse goes right over St. Louis.
Right, you and Brian Stivel are going to be here.
Oh, really? Okay.
Hopefully, I'm here then.
Hopefully it's not you'll be there. Hopefully it's not cloudy that day.
Hopefully not. But I really think my other plan is to get a lot more travel in. You know, it'll be nice to just travel without having to do lectures, to just go places and visit people.
Yes. Are you? Have you retired from the university yet?
I have reached early retirement, though. I can retire at any time. So the longer I work, the larger my pension will be when I finally do quit.
Yeah.
But
Sigrid's nodding.
What's that?
Sigrid's nodding right now. She came with me to the studio today.
Sigrid, hi.
She said, yeah, me too. She says hi back.
Yeah. So she's in the same spot that I'm in. So you keep working and just while you can. But
yeah. No, but well she's not nearing retirement or anything, but she has the same cycle. Like, oh, the longer I'm there, they don't take my pension and throw it into some bad investment and wipe it out. Yeah, some scheme.
Well, up until a certain age in my system, you didn't get a pension until you reached a certain age.
Ah.
So.
They try to get people to leave early to get so they don't have to pay them as much, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, hold on as long as you can. What interests you now after this? You've got to keep your brain going with something, Ken. If it's not going to be
JFK. Well, Greg, the girl I'm seeing now is younger than my daughter. And, you know, so I'm an old man chasing a very young girl. So that keeps you busy.
I guess it does. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm going to say anything else. But, you know, I'm interested in flying now. I'm doing that a lot. I'm interested in, you know, California history. So I'm reading up more on that. Yeah. I still like the paranormal thing, but it's just one interest now, not my overriding main interest.
Right. Well, you know, I work for the State Historical Society here. I'm all about the history of Missouri. You keep me busy. I got to go to banquets and function as a, you know, professional historian, basically, archivist historian. So that's a 40-hour a week job. Takes a lot of concentration. And, you know, I'm not going to be bored, that's for sure.
I don't know why this comes up in my mind, but what is the nastiest exchange or fight you've got in with anybody over the period of the entire time you've been doing this, and how did it turn out? I mean, okay, first, your craziest fight, and then who's the most worthy foe? And don't say me, because I'm not.
You're not a foe, but you're quite worthy as a sparring partner. There is a long exchange in this new book, Popular Parapolitics, about some guy who was particularly nasty. I just got off in the Facebook chat room with Spirit Light is the person's name.
Sigrid showed me that.
What's that?
Sigrid showed me that one. That was great. The Flame War. Captain Capslock.
The thing is, I go to that person on. See, this is the thing about part of what's happened, even with the online discussion, is that it wasn't the technology that finally eroded communication. It was things like the way Facebook is handled, where somebody posts something, you can't argue with them about it. You have to like it. You can't just say, oh, I read this. You have to like it. And there's all this glad handing that goes on. It's cute kitty pictures and all this other shit that goes on. That tries to make everything so up, you know, and it's hard to get into a fight. So I was kind of grateful that I did that with Spirit Light. It was some idiot just didn't know what they were talking about, and it was quite easily to trot them out. And I mean, the only thing it takes to make people like that look foolish is to hold up a mirror to them.
Yeah, I had. I've put up most of the nasty comments that come on the Radio Misterioso site. One of them just said that, what did it say? I can't remember. Something like I was a horrible, that's whoever it was said I was a horrible fraud and completely dishonest. And I knew that, you know, I knew what most of what I was saying was lies. And I was like, what? One, you know, one, it didn't say have anything past that. And two, if I'd said anything like, no, I'm not, then it would have gone on for the next 3 years, you know. So I just I just deleted it because it wasn't very useful. It was something that said, you're wrong about this and here is why. Yeah, I put that up.
Yeah. Like I said, I goaded this woman on. I don't know why I think it's a woman. I can't tell one way or another. But I goaded this person on more than I would have. I mean, the only thing you really need to do is shut it off. I just felt like having a good old-fashioned knockdown drag-out with somebody who hates me. So.
But that wasn't a worthy adversary.
Worthy adversary.
Somebody who made sense that you went on with for quite a while, had a useful debate. Can you recall anything like that?
I remember getting into a long discussion with Bill Cooper. Actually, about John Lennon.
Really? What did he
say? Trying to understand, you know, because Cooper was a working class guy, you know, and John Lennon represented everything that assaulted his way of life in the 60s. And you know, John Lennon was like this rich millionaire guy, and that kind of, you know, assaults my sense of ordinary people, you know, shouldn't worship rock stars. Yeah. So we kind of ragged on Lennon while at the same time disagreeing for a while.
What did he say about Lennon? He just said he was a rich hippie, he didn't know what he was talking about?
Yeah. And I was trying to explain to him that I kind of feel the same way about it, but it's not a generational thing with me. It's just simply, John Lennon was like a rich rock star, and to hear him, you know, whine about being a working class hero, it kind of rubbed me wrong at the time.
Yeah, well, it did. Well, the thing, there was a journalist, a woman journalist that was talking to him during one of the bed-ins, and I saw this video, and I think other people have seen it, where she just says, well, you're just trying to pump yourself up. You don't care about peace. And I can't remember who it was, but I thought about that for a while, and my wife at the time said, yeah, well, she's right. It's just, you know, why should he care? And I was thinking, well, if you got to use your fame to do something, that's kind of useful, isn't it? Trying to make people aware that the thing, you know, not that everybody else wasn't saying the same thing at the time, but make people aware that people are treating each other badly and they probably shouldn't. I think that's a good use of fame, no matter what you think of Lenin himself or what his personality was or whether he was rich or anything.
Yeah, and actually, how could he use whatever he had to do what? To protest the world the way it is.
Yeah.
Give away his wealth, you know, write different kinds of songs. I mean, he did what he could. And the criticism is, for me, is not really of him personally. I actually think he was a wonderful guy and a fantastic songwriter.
Yeah.
But it's just these kind of hardwired disparities of wealth that, you know, I think people need to factor in when they're thinking about him or anybody else that they, you know, they might have stars in their eyes about, you know. Hero worship kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's worse than it was. It's far worse than it was when he was not paying attention to the disparity of wealth. I think he did have some ideas about class and the inequity of class and all that, especially in the British system. When he, especially when he said that, you know, all you can clap and all you in the upper seats can rattle your jewelry or whatever it was,
just dangle your jewelry, right?
Yes. There was an idea about class and the inequity of it.
He was great on that. I mean, but he just never really faced the contradiction.
Yeah.
Of, you know, his own burgeoning wealth and the kind of decadence of the whole rock and roll world compared to, you know, its working class roots.
Yeah. It kind of annoys me when people get mad at celebrities. They should be talking about this and they should be doing this. Like, well, as long as they're not being dicks, what difference does it make to you what they do? Especially if they're trying to do something nice and something helpful, and especially quietly. Richard Gere does this. You don't see him in the news. He doesn't make big announcements. He doesn't walk out in front of everybody and say, I'm a peaceful Buddhist and blah, blah. He just quietly goes about supporting these things. What's it? Tom Selleck used to go down to the, soup kitchen for years. Didn't say anything about it. And serve meals to people give money to the, you know, to the mission there and all that. And, you know, so there you do what you can in the way that you can. Even strangely enough, Harrison Ford, with all his millions of dollars, and he's a pilot. He goes out and works for free on rescue missions and search and rescue.
Who is this?
Harrison Ford. He's a pilot.
Harrison Ford, okay.
Yeah, he's a helicopter and airplane pilot, and he goes out and helps people. Huh?
I'm still getting tremendous dropouts, so I can't hear half of what you're saying.
Sorry. He's a helicopter and airplane pilot, airplane pilot. He goes out and helps with search and rescue missions and donates his time if he can as a pilot. So, you know, you do what you can. Why not?
I find it a little tiresome when I hear any of these wealthy celebrities do anything. I mean, they're doing things from an abundance of wealth. You know, he has the time and the resources.
Well, there's plenty of celebrities, and rich people that do nothing.
Well, yeah, but most of them have some kind of hobby that makes them look charitable. Let me get this out about popular parapolitics.
Because
you may have one or two listeners that want to get these copies.
Or ten.
This is. In doing this book, it's been one of the more frustrating pathways to publishing that I've ever taken. Part of the reason why I don't really feel like doing it again. But it's with Fiji Press, and the name of the book is Popular Parapolitics. And it collects a lot of my last essays, different thoughts about how conspiracy filters in through popular culture. And because it was delayed, I didn't have copies to sell when I was in San Jose. I haven't had I turned the book in a year ago, and I'm just now, when I got back from San Jose, I got a few copies in the mail. Anyway, to make up for all this shortfall, my publisher, it wants to give away like 30 copies of the book that he's paid for. So there's a way to do this online.
Yeah.
So people want to get my last group of essays. The way to do it is to go to www.fejepress. That's FEEJEE press.com, then a backslash, and then JFK. There you should find an order form. If the order form requires a password, although I understand it doesn't now, but if it does, the password is Elvis.
Why would you need a password to order a book?
I'm not sure. Like I said, he took it off. He took it off. Groucho Gandhi, my mutual friend, you know, he published Go Rightly, too. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the book is fabulous. I mean, I love the book. It's. I wish I'd gotten it a lot sooner. It would have encouraged me throughout this year. You know, this was a year I knew, because this was the 50th anniversary, that, you know, things are going to go one way or another. And had it been a more successful year, I might have been encouraged to go on, but it was kind of disappointing. I did that talk in L.A. That was fun. And then I was hoping. I had people in like three or four cities who were trying to set things up. None of it ever materialized. The only person who ever came through was Skyler. She set that whole thing up in L.A. But then I came back out to visit her a couple weeks later, and she disappeared.
Yes, I remember. We hung out. I'll set up a thing for you, Ken. It'll take me a little while. And I still have that projector I bought for your lecture. And I've used it. It's become very useful around the house and for some stuff with cigarette. I even used it for a weird California talk a few weeks ago.
Right. Well, you remember, I was going to pay for it. Once you fronted it, I was going to pay for it, because I fully intended to do like three or four lectures and fully intended to need it.
Well,
but
I think
it just didn't turn out that way.
I think we can. If you need to use it when you're out here, obviously you're completely welcome to it. But yeah, it's become quite useful for me, so I don't mind. I really like having it.
Oh, okay, well, great. It is a nice little tool.
Yeah, I mean, I wish there are smaller ones made, but don't look as good on the wall. Well, unless you pay like, you know, a couple $1,000, then you can get wonderful ones that are tiny and you can carry in a suitcase and all that. So.
So,
well, we didn't get to the second part of that worthy adversary question. Who's the craziest person? Oh, well, we do know Ken. There's that guy.
Oh, Dan. Yes. Dan.
Yes. I give you all the money for that next issue, Ken. All you got to tell me is why.
I talked to him like a month ago. He called my office.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he had the same thing. This is very interesting. It was, I just want to know why. I mean, he had a whole series of people in his life that had died of one thing or another, and he was trying to turn it into a big conspiracy that, you know, that everybody's dropping off around him. And he's been doing this for years, right? And it's just not quite getting him. So, yeah, I had a conversation like that with him and in San Jose.
Oh, he was there.
Little Jim showed up. Have I ever told you about Little Jim?
Was he the guy working with Dave Childress out in Kempton?
No. I met Little Jim many years ago, almost the same time I met Big Jim.
Big
Jim.
Martin. Oh, okay. Okay.
Right. So I had a Big Jim and a Little Jim. It's quite interesting because this girl I'm seeing now, I call Little Jess or Big Jess, and I've got an assistant at the office named Little Jess. I do this people assign them sizes. Anyway, Little Jim is everything that people expect me to be. A fast talking guy. He's up on every single conspiracy thing in the world. I mean, in many ways, very, very brilliant. But he has the annoying habit of saying "and everything" after everything and everything. And I've known him as long as I've known Dan and his why, known this guy and his and everything. And he drives me nuts every time. And the thing is, he's my biggest fan. He shows up all the time. For years now. And he's a Teamster. He drives a truck. He's the guy that supplies all the cupcakes for the 7-Elevens in San Jose. And, you know, he takes me out to eat. We actually have a really good time. And I love that, you know, and I love that guy. I even love Dan. I love all those weird little idiosyncratic people that I've run into over time. I will miss that when it stops happening.
Well, he wanted to know why he was being followed, actually, Dan did.
I don't quite love it. When it's driving me nuts, I'm like, fuck this. But afterwards, it's like, damn it, isn't that sweet? Isn't that cool, you know?
Yeah. I've never had anybody, crazy people follow me around like that. I did have that one woman draw me that picture of me with all the implants in my face, which I'm eternally grateful for. The implant picture with all where I look like a gorilla and I got lines all over my face showing me where all the alien implants are.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, it's on Facebook. It's up on my pictures. Rob wanted a copy of it, and so did Adam Gorightly, so I just put it up so they could see it. I almost threw it out. I found it in the trash when I was cleaning stuff out. I was like, oh, God, not that picture, because I want to frame it and put it in the house.
I'm gonna take a look at it. You know, I unfriended Rob.
Why?
All he does is put up football scores. I don't even know football scores. Seriously, I mean, he wasn't dealing with any topics anymore, anything other than football.
We all slipped into something, and I hope that we all slipped into something at least interesting to us. And if I have Rob on, he'll talk about all that stuff. I think he still follows it all. He just doesn't want to really care to write about it because he probably got burned out and probably realized that, you're like, I can do this forever, and people are going to listen, but that's all that's going to happen. And he's probably learned as much as he wants to.
It's kind of the same thing as happening to you and happening to me. We're getting old. We're middle age now. We've done this.
Yeah.
You've been there, done that. You know? Things do end. Things are over sometimes.
Well, I hope the show isn't. Yeah. I hope I can keep doing the show. It's the only thing that kind of keeps me tenuously connected to all this. And also gives me a chance to talk to people, have fun, crack jokes, and people actually like the show. There's like 900 subscribers, anywhere between 600 and 900 subscribers to the show. I can't believe it.
That's great. That's great. You know, I was I listened to one today. I listened to that last interview you did with Skyler.
Oh, yeah, the one called Rapid Fire where we were just – well, anytime Skyler's on, it's Rapid Fire.
That's right.
She said she didn't get to say much. I actually went – that show is about an hour and 30 minutes. And we were here about an hour and 40, 45. I cut out all my jibber-jabbering so that her and Tim could be on more. I actually cut out a lot of my stuff. Because she felt like she didn't get to say very much. I said, well, if I cut out most of my stuff, there's still about 80% of the show left. So, yeah, she did get to say quite a bit.
She's such a nonstop talker. Her idea of not being able to say much is different from normal people.
Yeah. Well, I did write to her. I say, look, I took most of my talking out where I went on for a long period or something that I don't think people would find interesting. If it's my guest talking, it's going to just about always be interesting. So I left that in. No problem. But, yeah, I want to keep doing the show. I want to keep talking to other people. I'm going to have that the Humanoids website guy on again, Albert Rosales. Bob Emenegger said he wants to come back on again, and he's always an interesting guy. And some of these people, especially Emenegger, half the time we're not even talking about UFO stuff. We're talking about his career in the entertainment business and how he knew H.R. Haldeman and how he knew how to spend the afternoon with J. Paul Getty, which I have to get into him with on the next show.
You know, Haldeman's book, The Ends of Power, has something in it about JFK, the JFK assassination. I think Haldeman was the guy who surfaced the idea that whenever Nixon on those tapes would refer to the Bay of Pigs thing, but that was his coded reference to the assassination. I think that came out in Haldeman's End
of
Power.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
Are any other presidents recorded anything anymore? I don't think they did after that. They're just like, screw it, I'm not going to get in that trouble.
Oh, I'm sure they're under constant surveillance. That's one of the things that bothers me about these stories of Assange and these other leakers that they supposedly expose. What are they exposing? You know, and I've checked a few different articles. There's a documentary about Assange now that I need to watch. But what do they expose? When you finally get down to what that is, it's never really made explicit in any of the articles I see. And, you know, my background on this is the book that I wrote about Danny Casolaro, who exposed the Promise software.
Yeah.
The point I've made time and again is that, oh, my God, they spy on each other? I mean, that's the least of what they do. It's, you know, the two words that are left out of this discussion is extrapolation capacity. That was a state of the art when Casolaro was investigating Promise back in the early 90s.
Yeah.
You know, my God, I'm sure we'd be truly shocked now at what really goes on. And it has nothing to do with these so-called whistleblowers.
Somebody said to me that they have the idea that Snowden was basically an inside job and nothing that's really important is being revealed to us. And that was just kind of it was planned by the NSA.
Well, yeah, he's in Russia now, right?
Is he still stuck in the airport?
Editorials published where he's saying the same thing. You know, well, I didn't do anything wrong, really. So there's a long history of that. This goes back to Oswald, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oswald went to the Soviet Union. That's one of the things I like to point out to people, particularly after watching this Parkland movie. That was based on, I didn't realize it was based on Victor Bugliosi. But Oswald, the very, very simple biography on Oswald is that he flew out of the Tsugi where the U-2s flew out of. He gave the Soviets the information they needed to help bring down Gary Powers' U-2 plane. The job that Oswald had before he got the job at the book depository was with Jagger Child Stovall, a photographic firm that processed U-2 imagery. Everything that Oswald did in his young life was connected to the U-2, which, of course, you know, was developed and flew out of Area 51.
Yeah.
So all that's true. If he was also just coincidentally the lone nut who shot Kennedy, that's a pretty pretty large coincidence that you have to take into account.
Yeah, I mean, that the character of Oswald is, you never know. I mean, it is way, way, way stranger than fiction. And
well, yeah, I mean, that's what I was getting at. In the lecture that I did in L.A., actually, I stopped. I was going in a direction to L.A. that has to do with synchronicity and coincidence, and the history of that is a pop culture phenomenon and even something that's been studied by scientists. I mean, all that. But it got too obscure to be able to do a lecture about. So I switched over to the other thing. But it's... one of the points I was making is that Kenneth Arnold, for instance, was very much into coincidence theory, synchronicity theory. He gave his daughter a card that listed all the Lincoln-Kennedy coincidences. You know that, right?
Yes, I've played audio of that where somebody put I can't remember who put that together. I have one of Cab Calloway actually doing it. I guess he was interested in it.
Yeah, well. Kenneth Arnold gave that to his daughter. Now, his daughter still speaks on the circuit. You know, she still shows up at some UFO conferences. And she tells that story about how she had that card. But she, you know who she doesn't mention?
Crisman.
Crisman. Fred Crisman. She doesn't seem to know who Fred Crisman is. And yet, when you talk about coincidences, what about the coincidence that Kenneth Arnold was involved in investigating Fred Crisman, who Jim Garrison said was the grassy knoll shooter.
Yeah. And who worked for Guy Bannister when he was in Idaho and all this other stuff. It just, I don't know how much coincidence theory you could engage in. It gets weirder and weirder.
Yeah, well, and that's where I was going with it. You really, you know, you go down. Kenneth Arnold had some kind of epiphany where he was convinced that synchronicity had something to do with UFOs. David Icke is the same way. He was a sportscaster until some weird synchronistic event happened to him and turned him into what he is now. Bob Dylan talked about it in the last interview he did with the Rolling Stone. So, I mean, it's worthy of more stuff. you know, synchronicity is a very strange phenomenon. And it was, you know, Arthur Kessler wrote a book on the Book of Coincidences. And Jung, you know, basically didn't come up with the idea of synchronicity, but he named it synchronicity. And,
yeah.
And it's a very old, very, very weird part of the history of scientific development that this guy, Paul Kammerer, who was responsible for trying to establish the inheritance of acquired characteristics in studies of genetics, but whose appendix to that book, he was the first person to start cataloging coincidences, and he came up with it. He called it seriality, and Jung turned that into synchronicity. Anyway, it's a phenomenon that happens a lot, and my sense of Kenneth Arnold is that the event, the UFO event, is not just seeing the chevron flying across the sky, but being sucked into some kind of perception of these synchronistic connections. But, you know, I get so far afield from, you know, who shot Kennedy. There's
well,
no point in lecturing on that topic. Maybe one of these days I will sit down and write about that.
Well, you bring up a point here, and maybe I can ask you a question about it. The more, and I'll, from my point of view, the more I got involved in the weirdness around the UFO thing and the government thing, the more I seem to have that thing stare back at me and start affecting me. I had that period of paranoia for a year, and people actually were watching me. I mean, there's no way around it. Well, at least reading the mail. They're opening my mail and then sticking it in the P.O. box, all destroyed, from only two people.
Right.
And that's the only one I could really prove. The rest of them were like, I thought somebody was reading stuff off my computer screen. I had noises coming out of my bookcase like Carl Jung and Freud did. Just weird stuff like that.
Right.
And after the magazine stopped publication and I started doing other things, a little bit different, but not communicating so much with those people and writing so much about that stuff in such a concentrated way, that stuff kind of dropped off. And it wasn't just my I don't think it was just my perception of it. There was an external reality to it that other people could see. People could hear that noise in my bookcase, you know? And it wasn't, you know, rats or cockroaches or anything. There wasn't anything there. So who knows what's going on?
Right. Well, but you just decided to stop noticing things like that.
Maybe so.
You know, it was an act of will.
Yeah, that's
it's
true.
It's the same thing with synchronicities. I mean, coincidences and synchronicities occur all of the time. But you know, and remember what Wilson did with the number 23, for instance.
Yes.
You just turn it off after a while. You can see it if you want to.
Yeah, but things
but
like my mail getting tampered with.
The
mail getting tampered with. That's not a perception thing. That actually happened. I mean, if I could show that to other people, I could show it to them now, and it'd be the same thing. This mail, all these pieces of mail from these two people were either tampered with or destroyed or, well, it didn't make it to me. I can't show them that. But that's not a perception thing.
Well, I mean, you could have had an inept postal worker, right?
Yeah, I guess, who chose to lose, destroy, or mutilate every single piece of mail from these two people.
Oh, from the same people.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, Bob Wilson's letter would come through fine, but Carla Turner's would always be destroyed or opened or mutilated in some way.
Right.
Until she started.
Well,
go ahead.
Really, I felt early on that the whole point of doing something like Steam Shovel and writing what I wrote was to inoculate myself from paranoia. You know. To meet it head on.
Well, I wasn't just talking about the paranoia.
So that when it happens, it doesn't really rattle me too much.
Yeah. Well, that's a good... You took a proactive stance. Mine was just to stop worrying about it. But it wasn't just the paranoia. It's just the idea that when you stare into something or pay attention to something, whether it be a thing, a concept, a person, a field of inquiry, some goal you have, it stares back at you and interacts with you. And I think that actually really does happen. And whether it's perception or not, doesn't matter. It affects your life, so it's real to you.
Yeah, and that's real enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Did that... Well, actually, weird things did happen. You got that ad from Heaven's Gate that you ran in Steam Shovel one year, and then the next year they were all in the news.
Yeah. That's right. Oh yeah. Well, I mean, that last trip to L.A., you know that story, right? Skylar set me up at the Cecil Hotel. You remember this?
She set you up? That's right. You stayed there, and then the next week?
She suggested it to me, and then you told me about what a past it had, and I thought that was kind of interesting. So I stayed there and did my thing, and then when I got back, a couple of days after I got back, all over the news, all over CNN, the national news, this woman, I forget her first name, her last name was Lam, L-A-M, her body was found in the water tower at the top of the Cecil Hotel.
Yeah.
And they had footage of her on an elevator there, doing very strange gestures with her hands. And it was this enormous murder mystery.
Yeah.
I sat across the table from that woman when I was there.
You did?
And in fact, watching these news shows about her murder, the bookstore that was they talked to everybody at that bookstore. I think it's called the Last Bookstore or something down there.
Yeah.
And then all the footage of the hotel lobby. I mean, I was just there. And it was the major news story when I got home. So that was an interesting coincidence.
Yeah, for a little while. It was all over the place. And, you know, you who knows, you may have been taking showers in the water that she was.
Yeah, so apparently that's how they found out about her.
Yeah, because
about the water.
Yeah, the water pressure was bad, and then it's like had funny stuff.
That was
in
a few days after I left, though.
Oh, okay, so. Okay.
Yeah, it's still a mystery. They don't really know what happened to her. She drowned. They're saying she was on something and she drowned, but she couldn't have gotten access to the water tower without keys. So somebody must have given her some kind of access.
Yeah.
At least, so they don't really know what's going on there.
A Chinese woman for a Canadian citizen, I think.
Right. You got her up on the screen there? What was her name? Lam was one of her names.
That's so funny that that's her name. You do know the significance of Lam, right?
Yes, yeah, the collie business,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
The last important thing I heard about the Lam image, and I think Reagan Lee noticed this, is that if you look above the little squinty eyes, there's these big swirly black things on that creature's forehead, which look like big alien eyes. They're just in the wrong place. They're just shading. They're not the actual eyes. But if you squint, you can see the Whitley Strieber alien in Lam. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, wild stuff.
So all this weird stuff goes on. Do you want anybody to call in? We've got 20 minutes left.
If I could take a quick break here for like a minute.
Okay, well, let me find...
Can you feel the call?
Yeah, I can feel the call. I can...
Okay, hold on just a second. We'll be back.
Okay. Well, Ken's going to take a break. I was going to play some music here, but I would have to change the lead coming out of the phone. Anyway, the number... To call, somebody called earlier. I wonder if it's Spirit whatever from from Facebook. That'd be fun. 213-252-0998. And I'll put the phone up to the speaker so that Ken can hear you. That's the primitive system I still have here. But it works. I'm going to leave the system like this. It makes a decent recording. Everybody can hear it. Except when I talked to Albert Rosales and it kept cutting off for some reason. I'm going to have him on again probably in a couple of weeks. He said, yes, I'll do it. And he also said, I'm so sorry last time. I was so out of it. I was kind of tired. I hadn't gotten enough sleep. I really wanted to go to sleep. I got the time wrong. Anyway, so I want to have Albert on again and talk a little bit in more depth about the humanoids site that he has. Which is, like I said, one of the few things that keeps me interested in the UFO thing, because it's just, it's like reading old UFO books when I was a kid to me. You know, you go from the Adamski step. The first UFO book I remember reading was Inside the Spaceships.
Are we still connected?
Yes, we're still connected. I'm rattling on. I was saying the first UFO book I read was Inside the Spaceships by George Adamski.
That was the first one you read, really.
That's the first one I remember reading. And then I started reading a bunch of the other ones, you know, and got more into it. I started reading, you know, the Hynek books and the, what's his name? Flying Saucers Are Real. Flying Saucers Are Real was, well, whatever. And, you know, the Harold Wilkins book, Flying Saucers on the Attack. Just, I kept going and going until I exhausted all the UFO books. But One of the few things that still keeps me interested is reading humanoid encounter stories, because I'd like to believe that at least some of them are partially true and people encountered something that isn't human. And if not, it's still fascinating, you know, fascinating read, especially some of the weirder ones that make no sense whatsoever.
Some kind of psychological reality there.
Yeah.
Well,
if you heard the shows in the last year or so, I've been harping on this co-creation of the UFO thing where we don't know what we're looking at. We're not exactly sure what we're looking at, but our subconscious, while this is going on or trying to remember it, is furiously searching somewhere to have something to hang on to. And so it contributes a lot more than we think to our experience and memory of a UFO encounter or a paranormal encounter. Or, I don't know, maybe we could push this into parapolitics. I don't know.
Well, I haven't had that many paranormal experiences. I have seen a nuts and bolts craft.
What? The one at Area 51?
What's that?
The one at Area 51, the light?
Yeah, and I have it on video too. I've told you the story many times, I'm sure. In fact, that was the very time I met Sean Morton for the first time. You'll be happy to learn.
Oh, he was out there at the mailbox when you were doing this?
No, he was actually at the Little Alien.
Okay.
It was like 1991. Wow. I was talking to Sean about this in San Jose, and I always put it at 92, but he said it was the fall of 91.
Well, he's probably got a good memory. I'm surprised they dropped the fraud charges against him, huh?
Well, I didn't get too much into him. I understand he paid a bond or something.
Oh, okay.
So the discussion really didn't go there. We were just kind of
well, of course it did,
because we've known each other for a long time. And in fact, I have very fond memories of first running into Sean in 91. He was a young guy. He knew his shit when it came to the lore of ufology. And he was holding court at the Little Alien with these old geezers. And, he was fresh and new then, and it was before all the terrible things that have happened to him since. So
poor Sean, all the horrible things that are visited upon him. He didn't cause any of them, that poor guy.
Well, whether he caused them or not, they're still horrible things.
That's true.
Doesn't
mean I have to feel sorry for him.
Fine. I mean, but if he's still out there doing them, then that's too bad.
I think he's kind of laid off some of that.
I don't have a dog in the hunt, you know.
Yeah.
If he hurt himself, that's bad.
Yeah.
If he hurt others, that's worse.
But yeah.
That doesn't change, you know, the way we were in 1991.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I had a news crew with me. We talked this news crew into going out with us to film whatever was going on out there. Again, this was like 91, and they filmed a bunch of stuff. Most of it was just these like military flares, but there was this one disc, really kind of like an Adamski craft, that was clearly metal and clearly a disc, and it zoomed to a horizon point and disappeared, and then zoomed back in and then did it again. It was the weirdest damn thing. Even now, I have a hard time describing exactly what that was, but it was unearthly. And when we got back, the news crew said they weren't, reneged on the agreement. They just said they weren't going to give us any of the footage. And they did some kind of feature that night at the hotel, and it was, a UFO fan guy had his camera on his television in his hotel room, and in that feature, they mostly showed the military flares, but they showed a few seconds of this craft. And I got a copy of that video from that kid, and I still have that. So, it's not just a story. There's some documentation to it.
Yeah, are you going to put that up somewhere so we can see it?
Well, I've made it available for the longest time on these DVDs. If I could sit down and conquer my computer, I suppose I could transfer them all over to YouTube videos. But it takes a lot of work and a lot of expertise. And I have a busy week most weeks. Working full time and taking care of the farm. Somebody's really desperate to see it. Let them get in contact with me.
I'm desperate to see it. I would love to see that footage. You've described it to me many times, and I've never seen it. I don't think I've seen it.
I'm not making any promises. It's up there. I can do it. I just don't know when I'll get a chance to do it. But if I do get a chance, I will do it. I will make sure you get a copy.
Okay, cool.
Is that good enough?
that's great. So I would love to see whatever that footage is. The only impressive UFO footage. That's good and loud. The only impressive UFO footage I've ever seen, strangely to me, was something, a group of things floating over a mountaintop north of Las Vegas in the Nellis Air Force Base range. At least that's what I was told. But there's a little mountain, and I went out there, and I've seen that little mountain out there. You can see it from Vegas. But it's video, supposedly, and strangely enough, Eric Beckyord showed this to me the first time. Deceased, rest in peace, Eric Beckyord. And what it is a bunch of these lights, like four or five of them, flying around, not really in formation. It looks like a flock of birds, but birds wouldn't fly this way. And they're doing the falling leaf thing that UFOs are described doing, where they kind of float down, and then they kind of all regroup and zoom back up in the air and then float down again. And they do this like 4 or 5 minutes over this mountaintop. Maybe that not that long, but it was a fascinating film.
So did you record
video.
It?
If I find it online, I will post a link to it, you know, either on Radio Misterioso or on Facebook, because it's the only thing that's ever made me kind of scratch my head. Because it's before you could produce that kind of thing convincingly on video, and I saw it back, you know, like in the 90s sometime, in the early to mid-90s.
That was the early 90s, too?
Yeah, Beckyord brought it to the house of a guy named Gary Schultz, who used to have these UFO meetings in his apartment in Santa Monica. And they'd talk about, you know, the New World Order and fascism and UFO cover up and all that. You know, and I was young, and I was like, whoa, how cool. And at one point, Eric Beckyord brought a bunch of videos that he showed after the meeting. Everybody left, and I said, can I stay and watch the video? And they said, okay, yeah, sure. And that was the only, because the rest of them, I was like, yeah, come on, this stuff is crap. That one really made me stop and, you know, stop making fun, because it was, to me, it was impressive. And I think it still would be. I've seen it one other time since then. I'd like to find it.
Wow, yeah, I'd love to see that too. So we both kind of got excited about it back in the early 90s, huh?
Yeah, well, that's when that video came out, and people were, I think somebody was just in a hotel in Vegas and just saw these things and just stuck the video camera and zoomed it in at this mountaintop. And the thing is, they go behind the mountaintop, too. So it was something quite a distance away, at least somewhere in the Nellis Air Force Base range, which is really huge. And it goes north from Las Vegas and goes, I think, almost all the way to Area 51, and then widens out again. I'm not exactly sure of that. I'd have to look at a sectional map of that area of the country. But, yeah, it was
well, remember at that time, there was a regular night. I think it was like Wednesday night.
Yeah.
Where people would take tour buses up there.
Yeah, Sean Morton used to take people up there. Yeah, it was the Wednesday night show, and you could almost count on it happening then, because they figured, I guess, people wouldn't be out there then, so that's when they tested stuff. I think that went on for quite a bit longer than it should have, once they knew people were out there watching.
Yeah.
No, they probably wanted to know who was out there watching, so they got everybody's name and address and all that, and they could find out if they were, what their background was.
Right.
We got 10 minutes, Ken. As you know, as you can tell, when we were doing this show, I didn't go in here writing down any questions. So, Mr. Ken Thomas, you know, why do you believe this? It's just that we've known each other for so long, and I thought we'd just, you know, just talk, which is what I do with most people on this show.
Yeah, it's great. You don't have to rehearse.
No, I don't. I mean, if it's somebody I don't know, like when I had Albert on a couple of weeks ago, I wrote out like 15 or 20 questions, because that's the only way I'm going to keep on topic. But
is that right? Oh, man, it's been a long time since I've written anything down. You know, I mean, it's not like I pretty much know the material at this point.
You and I know most of the material we want to talk about, but if I want to talk to, you know, somebody I've never talked to before, at least on the show, I would like to have some basis for whereby we can continue the conversation. Uh-oh, somebody's calling with 10 minutes left. Let's see who it is. Just a second. Kill Radio.
Whoa. Ouch.
Kill Radio. I mean, Radio Mysterioso. Yes, we are still recording. Do you want to ask Ken a question? Oh, okay. Whoa, I don't think I looked at the email. Now you're on the air, or whatever it's called.
I'm on
here.
The air?
Yes.
Thank you. So what do you? I saw the Nova special as well, and the one part that intrigued me the most, or that I think needs the most thought or more explanation, was the claim that when a bullet goes into a brain, I'm putting it simplistically, that it causes the entire body to be stimulated, especially the back more so than the front, because there's more, and I guess a stronger nerve system in the back as opposed to the front of your body, and that's why his head jerked to the back and to the left. The other thing I'll mention is I saw that Assange special, and what comes across is that what he revealed, or what he, through the American soldier who sent him the information, was that there were a lot more civilian casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan than military was letting on. There's lots of videos documenting the nasty way we were killing civilians kind of wantonly. Like, you think what else? So I did order your book, and now I'm going to listen to your responses on the air, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you. Ken, did you hear any of that?
I didn't get half of it.
Oh, well, one part of it was about the part of it that I thought was I understood and that was relevant was that one of the points made in the Nova special was that the human body, if the brain is affected, especially by a bullet hitting it, something like some kind of trauma, there's an involuntary response, which is what made Kennedy his body jerk backwards as if he was hit from. Yeah.
So this guy believed that.
Oh, he hung up. No, I don't know if he believes it or not, but he said that was one of the points they made in the.
Right, it's bullshit. Kennedy got hit in the front, and his head went to the rear. You know, there was Luis Alvarez, who was a famous scientist. He's the guy who came up with the hypothesis about the iridium meteor that destroyed the dinosaurs.
Yeah,
he was hired by the CIA to perform the famous shooting the watermelons off of the ladder, and that would show once you shot from the rear, the watermelon would fall backwards. And the flaw of the science there was that watermelons on top of ladders are not connected to the bodies the way heads are connected by necks to the human body. I mean, it was that obviously stupid, and it was a world-renowned, famous scientist, Luis Alvarez, who did that, quote, science, unquote.
Yeah, well, I would like to see more evidence of people getting hit by bullets from the back and their head going back. There's got to be some sort of documentation of that somewhere, if that's true.
Yeah, well, I mean, once you get, you know, the basic facts and the timing of the Zapruder film, after a while, you just have no patience with all that. It's just convoluted crap trying to support, you know, this single bullet theory that defies all logic and all common sense. And there's just no way anybody can make it work. And you see people just go through gyrations trying to do that, trying to say, well, there's really two ways of looking at this. Well, there might be, but, you know, the two ways are not, one of them is not the single bullet theory.
Right. Oh, I forgot to thank the caller. Did not identify himself, but thank you so much for calling in. That was I've never heard that guy. I don't know whose voice that was. So thank you so much, caller.
All right. Thank you for that. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for listening. And I'd like to mention too that the conference that people need to pay attention to on November 22nd will be called is the Coalition of Political Assassinations, COPA. You can find them in D.C. if you had no plans and if anything I said might have tilted you toward going, you should go. Just look up COPA online and you'll get all the information you need. Now, there's still a chance that I might be there. I'm on the speaking schedule. I'm supposed to be speaking right after Doug Valentine, who I would love to meet. He wrote the book on Operation Phoenix. Right now it doesn't look likely I'll be able to make it.
Ah, shit. Oh, well. Well, I think I'm way overdue to come visit you, Ken. I don't think I'm going to fly out there because it's a lot more I'm not going to fly a plane out there. It's a lot more expensive for me to rent a plane to go there than to just get on a passenger plane and come out. But I've only visited you once there.
Back.
Yeah.
I've driven out there many times, and again, I'm too old to do it now. My back would not sustain a car trip that long, I don't think.
Yeah. Well,
you're welcome here anytime. It's a shame you couldn't get a layover when you went to New Orleans. Or it's a shame you didn't tell me you were going to be in New Orleans. I could have flown down there and we'll get a party.
Oh, well, next time we go, I'll tell you. That's too bad. Yeah, we were trying to find...
It's been many years. I used to go to New Orleans. I went to New Orleans like two or three times with this buddy of mine who wanted to commit suicide, actually, much later. And I guess that's kind of the reason why I never go back.
Yeah.
But it's New Orleans has been flooded and changed, you know, two or three times since the last time I was there.
Right. Hey, Ken, I don't have much... Bob Dylan, what do you want me to play? Let me tell you what I do have. I probably have, you know what I have is the song that Steam Shovel Press comes from.
Oh, that is so common.
Is it? Well, I don't have anything weird, Ken, because I am not a Bob Dylan fan.
Well, I guess that's a good enough. It's as good a song as any to go out on. It's like my swan song.
Yeah, I mean, I asked you, you said you didn't want to reveal it, and then one time I think on a show, or I did inadvertently, about needing a steam shovel to unload your head.
That's right. That's exactly right. I wonder how I would describe my head right now. It feels unloaded. All right, well, listen, everybody who's listening, who's followed me, thank you very much for doing it all those years, and I'm not going to disappear off the earth, but I certainly do appreciate everything that anybody's ever done to make doing Steam Shovel Press the great thing that it was.
Well, I certainly appreciate it. I'm so happy that we met, eventually ending up you being the best man at my wedding, which I still treasure. And
so honored.
Yes, and I will talk to you soon, Ken. Thanks so much for coming on again, and... best of luck and have fun and big giant pension to you so that you can continue to do what you want to do.
Right,
and come
great.
See
thanks,
us too.
Greg.
All right. Thanks, Ken.
We'll talk to you soon.
All right. See ya. Ken Thomas, good friend, longtime friend, incredible supporter, and another example of somebody who I don't have to agree completely with, who can be one of my best friends. Bob is coming up here in a couple minutes without the show. Meanwhile, here's from Buick 6 by Bob Dylan, here for Ken Thomas, our guest this evening.
dump truck.